From WVUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Praising your kids could be bad. Emotional pain could be good. Boredom is aggression, and sex is resistance. But change is possible if we just tell our stories straight. Psychoanalyst Stephen Groves has taken 25 years and 50,000 hours of therapy sessions, turned them into a slim book of Freud-like parables. This hour on Point, what we can learn from stories told on the couch. You can join us on air or online. Have you spent time in therapy? Or does the thought of doing that baffle you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Stephen Groves, psychoanalyst for the past 25 years and author of the new book, The Examined Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Groves, nice to have you with us. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, you've received rave reviews for this book. It's just out. Rave reviews all around the world, I should say, translated already into more than a dozen languages. What's the central theme or the message in The Examined Life?
Well, I think the key thing about the book is it's about change. It's really, at one time or another, I think all of us have felt stuck in our marriages or a parent with a child or child with a parent to work colleagues. Often we feel stuck with ourselves. We want to, you can imagine, diet or stop smoking or just learn a new thing or try and get closer to someone we love, and we find that we're unable to do that. And my book is really a series of stories. There are 31 stories which are about that kind of stuckness and how we get into impasses in our lives and how we can get through those and use those impasses to move forward in our lives.
And so is that the purpose of psychotherapy at the heart of it?
I think it is. I mean, I think the people who come to see me are in pain. The first thing is they're suffering and they're distressed because quite often they want to change something, but they're unable to do so. Often they don't have the words for it. They don't know how to put it into words. And so we have to sort of pull things apart a little bit, listen carefully, and try and find a way of turning that pain, which is also motivation, to use it to help them to move forward.
You write in your book that being a psychoanalyst means spending your work days, quote, alone with another person, thinking, trying to be present. You're a tour guide, part detective, part translator, an editor who helps patients connect the dots of their stories. I'm curious what initially drove you to the study of psychoanalysis.
Oh, that's a very good question. I think my upbringing. I grew up in Indiana. I think I grew up in a family where I think my parents were somewhat psychologically minded, but an immigrant background. My father wasn't born in the States. My mother was. And I think there were all sorts of things going on which I was curious about, feelings in the family which I didn't understand. And I had a wonderful older brother. I think I was about 15 or so, started giving me books to read. He was an undergraduate at Berkeley. I was in high school. And he gave me a number of books that really touched on that, the way we can not know ourselves. Some of those were things like Freud, but they were also things like R.D. Lang or Irving Goffman. There's a whole range of books about the ways in which we don't know ourselves or our true desires. And that idea really got a grip on me, and I became very interested in that and how people get separated from what they want and perhaps are self-deceiving or a mystery to themselves. Mm. And I became really interested in that theme.
You talk a lot about stories in your book and how stories help us make sense of our lives. In fact, you say, if we cannot find a way of telling our story tells us.
Yes.
We dream these stories, we develop symptoms, or we find ourselves acting in ways we don't understand. Help us understand that, Stephen Groves.
Well, I was responding to something Isaac Dinesen, the author Karen Blixen, said about all sorrows can be born if you can put them into a story or tell a story about them. But I'm really interested in what happens when people can't tell their stories. So often people come to see me, and of course the most difficult story from their childhood was the ones that their parents didn't have the words for and didn't help them to find the words for. Imagine like a divorce early in life in a family, and the parents' shame or discomfort about that. They may say certain things to their children, but they may, because of guilt or feelings, they don't know how to help the child articulate their feelings. I love Andrew Solomon's new book, Far From the Tree, and I love the first chapter of that where he talks about growing up gay, and he describes how his mother was fine with his dyslexia, but she wasn't really able to talk to him about the ways that he was growing up different from other boys. It wasn't that she didn't love him. She loved him, but sometimes we don't know how to put into words the most important things that a child may be going through. Those stories don't go away. They get buried in us, and they come out in all sorts of different ways. And part of what therapy may be about, and part of the stories in my book, are people who are then troubled or caught or in an impasse because of these stories, not being known to them, not having the words for them.
So in talking to your readers, is there a particular story from your book that you'd share with us right out of the gate here that has particularly hit home with those readers?
There's a lot of different things. I mean, as you said, I mean, in your introduction, I thought you summarized the book very well. There are stories about all sorts of things. The book's arranged, it's 31 stories, and they're organized into five sections. I think the first part's called Beginnings, last part's called Leavings. And I really try to capture life's trajectory from birth to death, and I try to really get stories that were about some of the most difficult things that we saw. There's one, well, I'll read for you just a paragraph from one story. This is called How Lovesickness Keeps Us from Love. And what I was interested in this story, this is just the first paragraph, but I was interested in self-deception. I think all of us know people who are, at the heart of this story is a woman who's caught up in an affair with a married man and continually believes that he will leave. Of course, he doesn't. And it's about how we slowly unravel that and how stuck she is with that for many, many, many years and won't move on. But the first paragraph is when I'm just trying to lay out to the reader something about lovesickness, and I'll read that for you.
Okay.
Mary N., a 46-year-old housewife and mother of three, was admitted to hospital in a manic state. Just before her breakdown, Mary had attended a neighbor's garden party with her husband, and they'd met a man named Alan, a recently widowed barrister. At some point in the evening, Mary and Alan struck up a conversation in the kitchen. They talked openly about his grief over his wife's death and hers over her sister's recent death from cancer. He proposed that she come to lunch at his house the following Friday. When Friday arrived, Mary showed up at his doorstep with a bouquet of peonies, a bottle of Sancerre, and a removal van containing all of her clothes and possessions, including some large pieces of furniture. Alan welcomed Mary and accepted her gifts. Not until he saw the movers did he begin to grasp fully her intention. When he refused to let her inside, Mary became frantic, crying and tearing at her clothes. Alan called her husband, who in turn called the family doctor.
I know you got permission from each of your patients before publishing the book, but I'm curious how they reacted to seeing their stories on paper.
Well, I've taken every care possible to protect my patients' privacy. I've changed all names and altered all identifying particulars to preserve their anonymity. And I'm also trying to protect their privacy without distorting the nature of the work. Like everything, everyone responds differently. And the people who read their drafts. There are a couple instances where I couldn't. People have died and so on. And there's some very small bits where like a sentence or two where I it's so disguised it would be hard to know who it was from. But in the stories, I do ask people's permission. And I think everyone's different. Some people glanced at it and said, yeah, it seems absolutely fine. Some people, one person wrote comments all over the draft that I'd given to him and then said, actually, I'm trying to write my story and you've written a different story, so let's just let you publish yours and that's fine. Everyone, I think, and that's one of the things about psychoanalysis and therapy, everybody is different. So I think everyone responded differently.
Everybody does respond differently, and I guess every psychotherapist is different. But what makes a good one?
I think the people to ask is usually the patients about what they think and how, if they feel that they're being helped. I think it's terribly important what patients feel about the quality of the work that they're getting and the work that the therapist is doing. I think most people go, as I said, because they're in pain, and the pain will often be anxiety or depression, and they want help in having, they're there to have those feelings lessened and made better. I think it's, at its very best, though, I think a good analyst or therapist is helping someone to live a better life. And they do that by helping the person perhaps to be more in the present, more receptive to this very moment, and to be available to the experience that they're having, not living too far in the future or too much in the past.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the examined life this hour, parents envying their children, marriages falling apart. We're talking with psychoanalyst Stephen Groves about all of it. He's seen it all in 25 years of private practice. A lot of portrayals of psychoanalysis in the media and elsewhere. Here's an HBO clip from the show The Sopranos, where Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini, tells his therapist, Dr. Jennifer Melfi, played by Lorraine Bracco, about a dream that he had.
My friend had a caterpillar on his head, and it turned into a butterfly.
Has your friend recently changed?
Not friend. Associate. And no.
What do you think the dream means?
Can't you just tell me what the thing means? I mean, you obviously know. Why do we have to go through this exercise every time?
I don't obviously know. I didn't have the dream. The meaning is elicited through verbalization.
And the gehoxagogan is framed up by the ramistam.
Stephen Groves, can't you just tell me what that means? Why do we have to go through this exercise?
Yes, that's wonderful, isn't it?
Do people often come to you looking for you to tell them the answer to their problems?
Yes, I mean, but it's a wonderful clip, isn't it?
Yes.
Partly because what I love about psychoanalysis and psychotherapy is actually it is a form of not knowing. You know, you have to do it together, and it is, you have to analyze, it's analysis, and the two of you have to think about things together. When I started, as every analyst has to have, I had to have a training analysis, and of course I had exactly the same feelings. I presumed my analyst knew everything about me from the minute I walked in the room, and he knew all my thoughts and feelings, and in fact it was quite a revelation to discover that no, he would have to infer it, think about it, listen carefully, and we'd work that out together. And by paying careful attention, you begin to discover how someone thinks and feels, what the things that make them sad, the things that make them happy, and so forth. And you begin to develop a map of that person's internal world.
Let's get a call in here right out of the gate. Ruby is in Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruby. Glad you called. You're on.
Hi, Jane. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of being able to, learning to tell your own story, I had a really remarkable experience with an excellent psychologist. I'd seen several who were helpful in this different ways, but mostly, you know, temporarily. But she made a huge difference in my life. She did what she called relational therapy in helping me develop relationships with people. And the first person that she wanted me to develop a good relationship was her. And she encouraged me throughout the week to think about the times when I thought about her. She wanted to know when I was thinking about her and what I was thinking, what I wanted to tell her. And this became a very, very difficult thing for me to do. I would think something, you know, I wanted to call you. It would be really hard for me to say in the upcoming week, I wanted to call you on Tuesday because some minor thing happened. And it in the process of analyzing all these times, it was so hard. I was so anxious to tell her these just banal things. It turned out that I was being really very controlling about a lot of my stories, I had no idea. I knew I was being, you know, kind of keeping a lot of things to myself, but I didn't realize that so many stories I was being so meticulous about, so controlling about every word, and it really released me to be able to just say something, and that this is my life, this is what happened, this is what I did, without any this constant anxiety.
Just to get it out. Ruby, thank you so much for calling. Let's get to some of the stories that some of your patients talk about in your book, Stephen Groves. You write about one theory that one of your patients develops, again, to this point of what's your story. I think she said the bigger the front, the bigger the back.
Yes.
Tell us what that means.
That was a story about, actually didn't happen in my consulting room, but actually happened on a plane. And I was flying in the States, and I was seated next to someone, and we struck up a conversation. And it was one of those conversations you have when you're traveling. And sometimes maybe it's because I am a psychoanalyst, and she was a doctor, and she told me a story about that she'd fallen out with her parents. In fact, she'd married someone. She was Jewish. She'd married someone who wasn't Jewish, Catholic and blonde. And her family disowned her. Their father stopped speaking to her. On the day she married, they sat Shiva. They went into mourning, and they ignored her. And she tried to make it up with them. Years went by, and then she got a call from her mom saying that they were getting a divorce, her parents were getting a divorce, and that her mother had discovered that for many years her father had been having an affair with his blonde Catholic secretary or receptionist. And then she said the phrase to me, the bigger the front, the bigger the back. And I thought that was just such a fantastic description. And we know that expression, and we know exactly what that means. When we know it with politicians, we know it with religious leaders who have a kind of moralistic view, but then are caught doing something quite immoral. And I thought it was much richer than there's a psychoanalytic term, a technical term called splitting, which is about how we project aspects of ourselves that we don't like into others. But I loved the simplicity and the dynamic nature of that. And it just always seemed to me very rich. Anytime I see in the newspaper a politician, particularly someone who's somewhat self-righteous, caught doing something that they really shouldn't be doing, I always think the bigger the front, the bigger the back.
One of your chapters is called The Gift of Pain, where you discuss silencing painful emotions and the fact that that comes at a cost. What did you mean by that?
Well, I was struck. That's an example of a young man who came to see me. And again, if someone doesn't feel pain, it's hard for me to keep them in the consulting room. That's a story about a failed consultation. It was a young man who had pointed a unloaded starter pistol at a police officer who was trying to arrest him for disorderly conduct. And he had gotten out on bail. His parents wanted him to come see me. He came and saw me. But during the interview, I realized that he was quite disconnected from his own feelings. He didn't feel pain. And there were a lot of reasons for that that we were able to get to in the consultation that I describe in the story. But what he reminded me of, he was a boy who didn't register his own feelings. And he made me think, there was a physician called Paul Brand who discovered that leprosy the devastation of leprosy wasn't a result of the disease itself, but rather a consequence of the inability to feel pain. And he once said something like, if I had one gift which I could give to people with leprosy, it would be the gift of pain. And it struck me that sometimes we are, all of us, capable of anesthetizing our pain. You know, people use alcohol, pornography, masturbation. People do all sorts of things not to feel. They overwork, they overexercise, they do many, many things. But when we succeed in feeling nothing, we lose the only means we have of knowing what hurts us and why we hurt. So in fact, pain's useful. It's useful not only for my work, but for all of us, whether you're in therapy or not, as a way of understanding what's important to you and what's not important.
Hmm. Here's Mike. He's calling from Boston. Mike, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Jane. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mike.
I have, of course, been in psychotherapy several times. I saw the same psychotherapist on and off many times. But I wanted to mention a course that I took in active listening. It was run by a minister at our church, and it was based in the work of Carl Rogers. And yes. It was in this course when I learned what a profound gift it is to sit and listen to somebody in a way without judging and without expressing or exposing your assessment of what was going on, but just to listen and hold their experience in your heart as you listen to them. And since then, I've been able to use that newly acquired skill many times, and I also realize what other people have done for me when they just listened and held my thought. It's a wonderful gift.
Mike, thank you very much. Stephen Gross.
You've put that really beautifully. And I've come to agree, I think as time goes on more and more, what people want from therapy isn't just insights and the help that therapy can provide, but it's also exactly what you're describing, that withholding judgment, the acceptance that a therapist can bring. And I think to be in an environment where you're accepted, active listening, someone's trying to think with you in a non-judgmental way, that is of such powerful value. And I think partly it has to do with, unfortunately, because as I began with a bit today, that sometimes in our families, we love our children or we are raised with love, but it doesn't mean we're always raised with acceptance and that non-judgmental. It's so hard with our own children. We want them to be successful. We want certain things to happen. And we push them, nudge them, frown on certain things, are pleased by some things, not by others. But if we can withhold judgment a bit and listen and try and understand, it's a very, very powerful force. I completely agree.
How much, Dr. Gross, is therapy now about psychopharm, about medication? Take this pill, you'll be better. It's not so much about talk therapy. It's about, well, it's about the other side of it.
I think there are lots of ways in which people get better, and medication's fantastic in many instances. And there are lots of things which work, and not just analysis or the kind of talk therapy. You know, there's cognitive behavioral therapy. There's many kinds of, and now we have things like mindfulness and some of the things which come from originally from Eastern ideas about meditation and so on. There are many different ways people get better. Some people do come to me, and I work with physicians and psychiatrists who are using medication on the patient. They will send them to me for the talking part, for the listening part. I think quite often, though, there are a lot of people who throughout their lives have self-medicated. You know, as young people went off to their GP, said they were depressed, got put on antidepressants, and now 10, 15 years later finding themselves still on medication or taking sleeping pills or medication for anxiety. And they no longer know what they feel. So they don't have a compass in the world. They don't have a map. And they're in their late 20s, 30s, and they don't know really in their dating, how to date or what they like or don't like. They're confused. And so sometimes people come to me wishing to come off medication or to be helped to so that they can better see what they're feeling. That's quite common.
Let's get Ron in here from Schroon Lake, New York. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was listening to the show, and a lot of the points that were being brought up hit home. And I just wanted to call because I've been diagnosed with bipolar depression. I've suffered from it for the last 20 or 30 years. And it's affected my life. It's affected my marriage, many jobs I've left, really looking back with really no good reason other than I was just in a depressive state and couldn't concentrate, lost interest in almost everything. And I am on medication now. It seems to pick me up. Mm-hmm. But I recently purchased a book on cognitive behavioral therapy. And it talks a lot about self-help and rituals and a state of mind of thinking that can help you propel yourself out of this. And I really, it hit home with me. And I was just wondering how effective that can be on your own without a therapist. Sometimes I feel as though when you see a therapist, you're talking about your troubles, and it's just more on your mind then.
Ron, thank you. Stephen Gross?
Ron, that's just a really excellent question. And, you know, I think, you know, you're talking about medication and then trying to find through books or through therapy something to help too. One of the things I think about bipolar depression, the people that I've worked with, is it can be incredibly lonely because of the struggling that you're doing. So sometimes having a therapist, and I think all different kinds of therapy can be helpful, but part of the power of having a therapist is to feel accompanied and someone to help you keep track of the things that send you up and the things that send you down, to begin to map out with you a kind of clear picture of your internal world. So which medications work, which ones don't work, to help you to feel more at peace with yourself. It's a very tough diagnosis to have. And again, it's also tough because, you know, you'll be a really rich, complex person, thoughtful. It sounds like that you're thinking about these things and trying to figure a way. I think the medication can help. I think books can help. But I think it would be great if you can have someone with you once a week and some sort of capacity to go with you on this journey, because it is just lonely and hard.
Do you think, Stephen Gross, that psychotherapy ever actually makes things worse?
It can. And I have a story in my book about that where I think I misunderstood something. We certainly fail a lot of the time. We get things wrong. That's not the end of the world. I mean, I think getting stuck or making things wrong, you know, getting things wrong in the first place, because we do that in our lives with our children, with our partners, at work. The trick is, if we make mistakes, to make the mistakes productive and to learn from them. Sometimes, though, there's an instance in my book where I describe a man who calls off a wedding. And this is a very unusual circumstance, and it's a very unusual case, but he's a description of someone who really can't be in a couple. And one of the biases of therapy quite often is that we all should be in couples and that people are happier being married or being with someone. That's true for most of us, but there will be some people who find that sort of intimacy not stabilizing but destabilizing. And he was one of those sorts of people. So he had been sort of nudged and pushed by various girlfriends, by therapists, trying to figure out what was the problem and push him forward. And it really wasn't for him. And so there's a story in the book about that, which I wanted to be in there just because, again, to show we're all different. It's not an unusual thing. I mean, there are famous examples that Franz Kafka was that sort of, you know, was engaged a number of times, found it very difficult to be with his fiancée, you know, and on the other hand, found it impossible to be apart, would write letters three or four times a day and so on. So I wanted to grab that sort of problem, write about it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Trauma, heartache, isolation are just some of the issues that psychoanalyst Stephen Gross sees in his patients on a daily basis. He's turned 50,000 hours of analysis into a slim book of his patients' stories. It's called The Examined Life, How We Lose and Find Ourselves. Here's some sound. Woody Allen, none other than Woody Allen, played a part in popularizing psychoanalysis in the 1970s and 80s with films like Annie Hall. Here in footage from United Artists, Allen's character, Alvy, tells love interest Annie, played by Diane Keaton, how long he has been in therapy.
I got time. Okay. I got nothing to my analyst appointment.
Wait, you see an analyst?
Yeah, just for 15 years.
15 years?
Yeah, I'm going to give him one more year and then I'm going to Lourdes.
15? Nah, come on. Yeah, really?
Just one more year. That's all I'm giving him, right, Dr. Gross?
Yes.
Listen, in part of it, your book, you talk about praise and children. And you talk about how praise can actually lower your child's self-esteem. Can you talk about that for a moment?
I can. It's it's one of the chapters that attracted a lot of attention. And it was, I'm an older father, I'm 60, and I have a 10-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. And I was struck, my daughter was peeling a cupcake, and a babysitter was there and started praising her. And I was, my wife and I looked at each other in a bit of amazement. And just the climate of praise around children and the general assumption that praise, self-confidence, and academic performance rise and fall together. In fact, there are some studies, there's a lovely study by Carol Dweck and Claudia Mueller, which shows that that's not really so, there's a difference between praising effort and praising a child as being really smart or clever. And I had grown up in a time when there was a lot of sort of thoughtless criticism. And so I just sort of thought they were kind of similar to me, the way that the generation around my daughter now was being sort of endlessly praised. And you can hear it everywhere you go, oh, good boy, good girl, you're doing such a, you're so clever. And the thoughtless criticism, and it seemed to me that in both instances, there was an indifference. You know, that if you're not really paying attention to what the child is doing, if you're avoiding thinking about your child and their world and what they're feeling, then praise, just like empty praise I'm speaking about, but empty praise, just like thoughtless criticism, is ultimately expressing indifference towards a child. And what really builds a child's confidence isn't criticism or praise, but it's being present with a child. It's really just being there and being involved. If a child makes a drawing, to look at the colors, to talk to them, to listen to them, to be actively present. And that gives a child the sense that what they're doing is worth thinking about. And without that, a child might come to believe that their activity is just a means to an end. It's just a means of gaining praise. It's not an end in itself. And we really can't expect our children to be attentive if we haven't truly been attentive to them. It's so hard nowadays with BlackBerries and iPads and the computers and television and all the things that go on in a family. But what I was making an argument for is being present, whether with children or our friends or even ourselves, that it's hard work, but it's the most valuable thing that we should be trying to be doing.
Here's Trudy in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Trudy. Glad you called, and thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I love this show. I already ordered the book.
Thanks, Trudy.
I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I got into psychiatric nursing by accident during one of the worst periods of my life. Yes. And I felt like I needed to practice what I preached, so I called a counselor. And that was in the 70s. And I have used counseling since that time as maintenance. I've never had, quote, a breakdown. I've never been in the hospital. I've never taken medicine. But counseling just helps me get through all the tough spots. And I call my counselor when I know I'm heading into troubled waters, you know, if somebody dies or I moved, had a big move years ago. And the first thing I did when I moved was find myself a good counselor. And I just wondered if Dr. Gross has other people who use counseling therapy like that.
Trudy, thank you.
Trudy, that's a great question. And actually, I think, you know, a lot of people come to the profession because of difficulties in their own lives, and they're able to offer, to work things out in themselves, learn things, and be able to help others. One of the key things in my book is, you know, why is change so difficult? Why do we find it so hard to change? And I think one of the things that's most obvious that I've learned from my patients, and I didn't really see until all the work that I'd done, but your question made me think of it, is that all change involves loss. All change, even a positive thing happening to us, getting married, getting someone we love, means also giving up a lot of other people. Leaving home to go to university or someplace a job we really want to do means we have to give up other things that may mean a great deal to us. And we will have mixed feelings. And sometimes we try to diminish or play down. I was struck that you said, you know, Trudy, that if there's a death or a move in your life, you like to go to a counselor. And in other words, that you find talking to someone about those things which will be sad in those changes appropriate. And to me, that seems to me a valuable thing to do. to be able to have those feelings and to find a way of talking about it. You know, some people will do it with a counselor, some people will do it with a friend. I think one of the problems is when we try to deny that, when we try to deny the losses that change entails. But thank you for your question.
Stephen Gross, you write in the book that it's not unusual for a psychoanalyst such as yourself to help a patient solve a problem that the psychoanalyst himself or herself has been struggling with unsuccessfully in his or her own life. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Well, that comes in a section of the book where I talk about parents envying their children. And really what I was trying to say is that, you know, it isn't just parents. It sounds odd. How can parents envy their children? In fact, I think we often do. Our children have one thing more than we do. They have a lot more life ahead of them, hopefully. And it's maybe surprising. We work very hard for our children. I think we live in a culture now, by the way, which is very child-focused. And we're so ambitious and working so hard for our kids. And we sacrifice and give a great deal to them and give them things perhaps that we never had. And sometimes we, are, I think, a bit harsh on our children and a bit think too well of ourselves and too little of them. That can happen. What I meant when I said that was it's not unusual for an analyst also, you know, a teacher can envy a student, a coach can envy his athlete, and sometimes an analyst envies a patient. Our patients can be, you know, brighter, more attractive, earn more money, and the key thing is this, that we have to unhook ourselves and get ourselves back to our place in time and back to our lives and to, I think, essentially feeling gratitude for the things that we have and the life that we're living where we are, and to find our place in time and disconnect, because otherwise we will suffer greatly if we get caught up in that sort of envy.
In the book, you're treating a patient whose husband is unfaithful, but she refuses to acknowledge this. And this gets you thinking about your own life. Would you read that section?
I will. That's absolutely right. That a patient who was not looking at something. And of course, one of the things which bothered me is analysts sometimes, I don't write much about myself in the book, but I felt sometimes when it was appropriate, I should be truthful and just say what my thoughts were. So this is a section of the book where a patient of mine, I was pretty convinced her husband was having an affair and cheating on her, and she wasn't facing up to that. Everything she was telling me just, but I had doubts. And so I write, this is during her treatments. Some nights I found it hard to sleep. I'd wake up, drink a glass of water, return to bed and lie awake, falling asleep for a few hours at dawn. I was angry because of something that had happened in my own life, and as a result, there were times when I thought that I might be putting something of my own problems into Francesca's analysis. Just before the start of her therapy, I'd gone through a difficult period with a girlfriend. There had been telephone calls. More than once, I'd answered the telephone and the caller had hung up. Away at a weekend, for the weekend at a psychoanalytic conference in Copenhagen. I rang home late one Saturday night, and my girlfriend didn't pick up. When I got home, she told me that she'd felt unwell on Saturday morning and unplugged the phone and took a nap and then forgot to plug it in. "I'm sorry," she said. "I only remembered on Sunday." A month later, we broke up and I moved out, and it was only when I unpacked my clothes and hung them up in the closet that I became aware of a man's shirt that did not belong to me. Lying in bed, thinking about how I'd been deceived, I could not sleep.
The clock's against me here, and I want to get a few more callers in. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Here's Janet. Janet, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've wondered if Dr. Gross, if you happen to have some ideas or thoughts, or if you go to a therapist yourself about feeling issues of secondary traumatization or caregiver, if you've ever had burnout from working with patients on various issues, and because as a therapist, I find myself extremely empathetic.
Right.
and seem to take on a lot of my people's issues.
Yeah.
Janet, thank you.
That's a very good question. I'm lucky. I mean, in my I live and practice here in England, in London, and it's a part of our professional society, the work that we do, that I'm in what's called the CPD, Continuing Professional Development, where I work, you know, I meet with colleagues and they present their difficult cases to me and I present my difficult cases to them. And we've worked together a long time. We know each other all rather well personally. So we can really let our hair down with each other and talk honestly about a case being difficult. In my book, The Examined Life, there is a case about a little boy that I saw, a child case, and for almost 2 years he spit at me. He spit in my face. And I describe getting really demoralized, really, really demoralized about that impasse. And I had wonderful supervision from colleagues. But eventually, it's by taking that work to another colleague and discussing it that we found a way through that impasse and found out what it meant, and it drew to an end. And I think that one of the ways of avoiding burnout or feeling that is by the support of colleagues, by talking to people, thinking about it, and feeling refreshed by the ideas of other people, being supported by them. I think that can be hugely important. There's nothing wrong with the feeling of failure or I'm getting this wrong. For example, I worked a lot with teenagers, and they want you to feel a failure, and that's often so they know, you know, how bad they feel to feel failure. They're trying to communicate it without words, and they need you to know, or maybe to need to make someone else fail so that they don't feel so bad, too. So sometimes we have to use that.
Here's Erin in Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Erin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead. Thank
Hi.
You.
I just wanted to comment on finding the right therapist. When I was a child, I was very depressed, and all through teenager years, that depression led to a lot of problems, interpersonal problems, and, you know, self-esteem problems. So I started to try to find a therapist. And so many of them were just not helpful. They wouldn't listen. They talked about themselves a lot. They didn't have any good advice. And I finally found one through a friend. I was referred to him by a friend. And it's been great. I've been seeing him for about 3 years now. And it's, you know, I'm on medication, and that just helps my mood right now. But I just wanted to also say, going through therapy when you have a mood disorder helps with all the problems that have come up and who made you who you are, so that you can deal with them and work on that aspect rather than just the mood aspect.
Erin, thank you. Stephen Gross.
Thank you for your question. I mean, I think my experience is not dissimilar from yours. I mean, in the sense that I think I do a lot of consultations. I think it's sometimes very hard to find the right person. I'm speaking to you now not only as a professional, but it's like I would speak to a friend that I would say to a friend who was looking for a good therapist to keep trying. And if the fit isn't right, then just go on to another person and keep looking till you do find someone, as you did, that you feel you can talk to. But more importantly, exactly what you said, that they listen and that they listen carefully to what you say and that you feel accepted. They're not telling you about their personal experience or anything else, that they're accepting and listening to you in a useful way and really trying to help. Because as we talked about earlier when with Ron's question, I think having some of the problems you're describing, a mood disorder or these things, can be so lonely and isolating. And the profound value of having someone who's in your corner facing this with you is to me just hugely important, and not to give up.
25 years of work, 50,000 hours of conversation, Stephen Gross. What have you learned from this professional journey in our last minute here?
Oh, I've learned so much from my patients. Things like this radio program, that Jane, it's so important to try and be present. You know, the people that have rung in, it's been a pleasure talking to you, but that if we can be here, not in the past, too much caught up with that, we can't change that. If you try to, it'll depress you. Not worrying too much about the distant future, can't change that either. But to be where you are and to talk to the people that are near, that you care about and that you're with, and listen to them and try and receive as carefully as you can the things that they're saying. It's the most important thing if you can do that.
The Examine Life is the book, How We Lose and Find Ourselves. Stephen Gross, thank you very much for your time today. Good luck, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a great pleasure being with you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow on Point, farmers across the country are struggling to keep up with the high demand for organic food. Will we have to go abroad to feed our appetite? That's tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.